Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to episode 91 of Real Talk JavaScript. I'm excited today to have Deborah Carrot as our guest, a good friend and excellent person to talk with about today's subject and, well, many others. But before we jump into that, I have the illustrious, the wonderful, the magnificent.
When did we start this tradition of just going way over the top? Hi, I'm just plain old Ward Bell.
No, that's not true at all. Ward, if you know Ward, you know
I'm plain old Ward Bell. Anyway.
What have you been up to, Ward?
What have I been up to? You know, just rocking out in this time of quarantine. The joy in the big queue as best I can. How about you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you said rocking out, I was like, do you start an online band or, you know?
Actually, there's a neighborhood band that plays out in the open air on Friday nights for 2 hours.
Really?
People come by and they have a tip jar, and each of the band members is social distancing outside. They're all 6 feet apart. And the neighbors all kind of circle around with their masks on and keeping 6 feet apart from each other and with lawn chairs and stuff. So it's kind of become a neighborhood tradition from 6 to 8 on Fridays. I kind of dig it.
How are they handling the choreography? Because I'm sure they do a lot of dancing while they do it, right?
You know, you can dance with a mask on.
Good point.
I think there was a song like that. There should be. Somebody should write, "You can dance with your mask on."
Yeah. You can dance with your mask on. Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm surprised. I wonder if somebody's made that. Probably not.
No, but you remember that? Oh, there's a great song. You remember that song? You can leave your hat on. Well, you can leave your mask on.
we can go for a while on this one.
We can.
But we won't. So let me introduce our guest, Deborah Carrot. A lot of you probably know Deborah, but if you don't, she's a software developer, speaker, and Pluralsight author with a focus on C# and Angular. For work in support of software development and software developers, she's been recognized with Microsoft's MVP award, and she's also a Google Developer Expert, or GDE. And she's on Twitter at Deborah Carrot. So first off, Deborah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what have you been up to during the stuff, we'll say, that's been going on?
Oh, just hanging out at the house. I mean, there isn't too much to do. The really nice part, I guess, is that our adult daughter moved back in with us back when things started. So that's been fabulous to have her here again. I never thought we would have that time again. When she went off to college, I thought that would be it. But now she's working from home here at our house and helping us with everything.
That's
grocery
awesome.
Shopping is becoming quite the chore.
Yeah, for sure. I can attest to that, even though my wife does the majority, because I'm not allowed to go to the store, really, because I come home with things that weren't approved for some reason.
You know, when you brought that tent home, that was a problem.
So, yeah, Deborah, I can totally relate to what you're saying, because my oldest son, he's also back with us. He's in medical school. He just got done with his second year. So it's been just awesome having him around all the time, even though it's under these circumstances. But
correct.
Well, today we're going to talk about solving common RxJS scenarios in Angular. And Deborah, I know you've dealt a ton with RxJS and streams and all that fun stuff. So you want to walk us through what are some of the scenarios that you hear about and what are people doing to deal with those?
Well, one of the things that people are really moving toward right now is using a declarative reactive approach in Angular using RxJS. So that means instead of having methods and doing a very procedural way of returning streams, you instead just declare variables. So you would have a products dollar variable that would be your stream. So one of the common questions that I get once people have gone through the basics and picked up on that technique is, how do you pass, and I say pass in air quotes, how do you pass data in if you're now dealing with a variable? So if you've got products dollar equals HTTP get, you know, blah, 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 how do you pass something to it if your HTTP request needs, like, what page of data you're receiving, or what ID of the product do you need, or, you know, something along those lines. So once you move away from the procedural where you can pass data, how do you get data into your pipeable expressions? The answer to how you pass data to an HTTP call is to instead create another stream. So it's really important once you really start working with RxJS in a reactive way in Angular to start thinking of your application as having actions. So, you know, what is the action that your application needs to perform in this particular case? What is the action it needs to perform in that case? So instead of thinking of passing data elements, you instead think of the action and then what value needs to be dispatched. So for example, the user clicks on next page. So they have a list of products and they want to see the next page. So how do you pass that, you know, next page information onto your HTTP request? Well, you set up a second stream that's managing those actions. It's managing that next action. So you use a behavior subject and you define I call them action streams. So you define a stream for that particular action. Then you can use things like combine latest. And combine latest then takes in multiple streams and then lets you work with both of them. And that's the way to kind of, again, air quotes, pass in information into your pipeable set of operators, is to start with something like a merge or a combine latest, where you can then pass in multiple streams. I'm hoping that makes sense without actually looking at code. I will provide a link that will show up in the notes here that will point you to an example of using action streams. It's actually based on a talk that Aaron Frost gave on doing pagination. So it knows how to do previous and next. It knows how to say, I want page 3 out of 10. I want to show 3 items at a time or 5 items at a time. So I took the information from his talk and created a GitHub repo with sample code for it. And I will put that link in the notes.
So I really do get what you're driving at there. And it's as you start to use RxJS, or at least I'm finding that, you get to think about all these different kinds of triggers that could come together to cause you to perform something else that in turn is observable. So as you say, maybe they click the page, maybe they change the filter, right, of what they want to filter, or maybe or some other kind of selector. And there are all these different sources of input that could trigger you to reissue that HTTP request and want to pass those parameters to the HTTP request. And there are other kinds of triggers too, like, you know, maybe they where you want to stop listening, or maybe you want it to have timeout, or, you know, any of these other kind, or cancel. Maybe you want to have a cancel button and say, I don't want to sit around and wait for that anymore. So you have all these things that users can click, and they're right, and they're all sources of information that would trigger this HTTP get, which in turn returns the stream of results. So that's a good trick to learn, I think. And it changes your mindset, don't you think, about how you look at RxJS?
Yeah, even though I don't use NGRX real often in my apps, just because a lot of the stuff I'm doing now just isn't big enough, complicated enough, still thinking kind of NGRX-y with the idea of actions being dispatched. You can think of that as being the behavior subject.next. It really kind of helps you start thinking about your whole app in terms of responding to actions as opposed to passing data or procedurally executing something.
Now, Dan, you've written another, you're one of the many people who've said, I'm going to write a state management, reactive state management thing. So you've got something in your sleeves there, and you must see this same dynamic, right?
Yeah, totally. The challenge that always comes up, and Deborah, you kind of hit it, is, for those, first off, let's maybe back up a little, because when we say things like combine latest or merge, or, there's a whole bunch of these operators, that's kind of what we're talking about. If you're new to this, is a way to operate on streams of data. And if you're new, the way I think of it, and then I'll get to what Ward was saying, is if you sit by a street and you watch cars go by, because that's pretty fun to do these days when there's nothing else to do, So you just look out your window and you're watching a stream of cars go by. Well, it's like an array of cars into the future, and these operators that Deborah mentioned are a way to, in essence, tap into that stream and like combine latest. I can say, hey, give me the latest car, and there might be multiple roads I'm looking at, and I want the latest car from that road and that road and that road and, whatever it is. So that's kind of the first thing. Now, the reason I mentioned that is, the challenge, and it doesn't matter if it's NGRX or just pure RxJS, or mine's called Observable Store, which is kind of it's a pretty easy way to get started with state management. You always run into this problem, though, where you made, let's just switch it up. Instead of just paging, you have multiple HTTP calls, and now you need to wait until all the results come back. And for example, we can use a fork join as one way we could do that. And so regardless of if it's multiple streams or you're passing data to a function or back or whatever, it definitely gets challenging. And I don't think it matters what state management solution you're using. If you're doing RxJS, you're going to end up dealing with these, challenges. So let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor.
Are you struggling to replicate the bugs and performance issues that are coming in from your customers? Well, plug Raygun into your web and mobile applications, and you can diagnose problems in minutes rather than hours. Kiss goodbye having to dig through log files and relying on frustrated users to report issues. Make your software development life so much easier by using Raygun's error, crash, and performance monitoring tools. Every team can create flawless software experiences for their customers with Raygun. Try it for free today at raygun.com.
So Deborah, what's another common stumbling point for people learning about reactive?
Well, a second one is how to retain a list of things, because previously they would maybe have a property and a service that would manage a list of, say, like a list of customers or a list of products or, any kind of an array. And they need to be able to insert stuff into that array and take things out of that array on deletes and so on, update things. So how do you do that in a reactive approach if you're no longer going to have these properties, but rather it's all streams? And the trick there is the scan operator. So as Dan mentioned, there are quite a few different operators that are available with RxJS, and one of them is the scan operator. And what it does is it lets you retain a list of things and add information to that list, take information out of that list. So what you do in your stream pipe then is to use that operator to manage your list. And I've got an example of that as well that I'll post into the notes.
Now, I don't know about you, Deborah and Ward, but when I first got started, well, first off, it was always a challenge just to learn the operators, but scan always, in fact, Ward, I think it was you, it was at ngconf, actually.
Yeah, I remember talking to you
about that. I don't even remember. How did you explain that one? I don't remember back. I think he did it with sports.
I don't either, but it was one of those ones like, who needs scan?
yeah, seriously. So I think it was sports scores or something like that. Gosh, that was years ago, but it was a great explanation. Is that something, Deborah, that, do you have a way you like to explain scan just for people that maybe haven't used it at all? Or what's your thoughts on that?
I sort of talk about it just the way that I just mentioned, that it's very similar to how you would do it yourself with your own array property in your service, that you write code to, add things or remove things. And scan is basically the same way, where it's managing this list of things and you're giving it, you know, whatever new thing that you want to add to it or remove from it, and then write the code to actually perform it. So it's not that much different than how you would do it. I don't really have a good metaphor for it, though. That might be something interesting to think about.
Well, why don't I try something? Because it works great for arrays, as you say, but it works great for any kind of object that you want to maintain as events fly by. So if we were to use the baseball analogy, like you had you're keeping balls and strikes and all that stuff. And so you imagine you have, so you're keeping, whether the balls, whether the batter is, like to say that. And so you have an object that has balls and strikes in it. It starts out 0-0. And the umpire says, ball one. And so that all you're getting is you have a single stream of these events. And the umpire said ball. So I increment the number of balls property. And then he says ball, another ball. So then it goes up two, and then it says strike, and then I update the strike. And so what happens is that I can increment and decrement that object. I can say, next batter, and then it clears it all out to zero. And so I can take that single stream of messages, and within the scan, I can interpret it and adjust an object. And that's kind of what you were doing with the array. Like you were saying, add this one to the array. And you say, okay, I got an array, I'll do that. No, remove this thing from the array. Oh, okay. Empty the array altogether. Okay, I'll do that. So the idea is you've got this sort of stream of messages that you're going to interpret and then do something with to adjust either an object or an array or something like that. And scan is just sitting there listening to this stream of messages coming in, interpreting them and adjusting some kind of a result object. That's the way I think about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really good.
Now, could I add, Ward, and tell me if this is even a way to look at it? I don't know. For some reason, this makes me think of The Incredibles. If anyone's seen the first Incredibles, they're sitting there scanning the police scanner.
Yeah.
It's a stream of police chatter, and perfect. They're scanning for, like, a robbery or a fire or whatever, because they want to go help because they're former superheroes. Is that an accurate way to look at it as well?
Yeah, because you can throw stuff away. You can say, I'm not interested in that one.
Yep.
So nothing's changed. But then suddenly it's a robbery on 24th Street. And you can output something.
Let's go. We can get them.
Yeah. So that's probably kind of where it got its name. You're sort of scanning an input stream to find things of interest and doing something when that thing of interest comes along.
Yeah. The other important bit of info, though, is that it retains this list or this object or this thing that it started with. So it starts with some kind of state. And then the second argument is this stream of stuff that's coming in, or, each item that's being changed. But it's retaining and remembering this set of stuff so that you don't have to manually somehow hold a property for this array or for this object that's being changed. It will hold on to that for you.
So yeah, I think it's that's kind of a surrogate for that whole, whatever it is that you're managing, like the balls and strikes and all that stuff. It's right. Living inside the scan.
Right.
So it's kind of like the umpire,
the little clicker he's got in his hand.
Yeah, they used to have a little clicker, or I guess it'd be like in the Incredibles one, it'd be like they're keeping notes or something, I guess, of the different things flying by that they're interested in. Because, if you're a superhero, you could probably solve two at once. But, okay, cool.
It's darn useful, but it isn't one of the first things you tend to learn when you're learning RxJS. You got your first handful of operators that you feel comfortable with, like map and stuff like that. For those of you who are wondering, it has very much the same structure. If you think about arrays, because observables are kind of like array thinking in time instead of in space. So if you think about arrays and all those nifty functions that are on there, like a map and take and skip, those are all things you can do in observables. Well,
reduce.
There's also reduce, and the structure of scan is very much like reduce. Now, observable actually also has a reduce, but which has a different purpose, but it has the same structure as reduce. So you can think of it as sort of a repeated reduction over time.
Do you have, Deborah, a favorite like resource you go to other than, you know, maybe your answer is I just go to the docs, but do you have any other resources you recommend? Because, you know, it can be really hard to keep up with all this stuff going on with observables and operators.
I do go to the docs because the docs are relatively good. I mean, there are a couple places that they could be beefed up a little bit, but that's always the first place that I go is the RxJS docs.
Yeah, I really like, for those that haven't seen it, in addition to the docs, they have the decision tree. And it used to be up on, it was kind of a chart type thing they had up on GitHub way back in the day. But now they have this really nice walkthrough. And I know there's going to be a link in the show notes to the docs. So if you haven't seen the decision tree, excellent. Very useful, especially if you're like me and you don't have all the operators memorized. Because what are there, like 500,000 of them now? Is that right, Deborah?
It's exponential. Hey, have either of you ever, when you went to the docs, have you ever hit F12 and looked at the console?
No.
No.
Well, you're in for a treat because they have, I do this all the time when I want to try something out, and they have a little REPL, which stands for what? Oh, man. What does REPL stand for?
You anyway, just call it REPL.
It actually has a mean. It's not just an acronym.
It's read, evaluate, something loop.
There
right?
you go. But in any event, you can go in there and you can try out different expressions that you were trying to work out before you actually put them into your code somewhere. It's a really good way to explore things that you aren't quite sure about. So check it out sometime. One of my favorite features.
That's nice.
The docs.
One, I'll add to the show notes here. One I like, and you know, I haven't visited lately, so I'm not sure if it's up with the latest version. But I don't know if either of you have been to learnarcsjs.io. It's kind of like an online book of sorts. But it has. It's nice because it'll link you right to examples for. I think it has like StackBlitz or JS Fiddle or maybe a bunch of them actually, if I remember right. But it's nice because it'll give you a starting point, you know, and a lot of times that's all that a lot of us want is we just want a starting point to, you know, jump in and kind of, how do I get started with this? Like, what is this thing? Like Scan, Deborah, that you mentioned. So
I also have a Pluralsight course.
Oh, yes. Well, we got to have your Pluralsight course link in here. So make sure you type that into the show notes because, you know, a lot of people have great things to say about your courses.
Oh, they thank do. You.
I'm not one of them, by the way. That's because
thank you.
That's it. You're out of the mass band, Ward.
I thought you were my friend, Ward.
Ah, Deborah. You know, Deborah and I go back, right? So teasing each other is one of those things that we do. We go way back, don't we, Deborah? Jeez.
A long time.
Yeah.
Well, you're not super far from each other, right? You're both in
Bay Area, yeah. Ward used to speak at our user group way back when. I mean, he did more recent also, but way back when we first started our user group, he was one of our speakers.
Deborah kind of got me into the whole public speaking thing. I kind of owe it all to Deborah, really.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that.
What else you want to talk about, Deborah, when it comes to these kind of scenarios or anything else that you tend to hit or run into?
Yep, I have one last one, and that is reactive forms.
Yes, the fun one. I'm doing my air quotes now.
The issue with reactive forms as it is right now is it doesn't play well with RxJS streams. You have to currently take everything out of your stream, basically, in order to put it on your form, because Reactive Forms has its own data structures and it controls the data in those data structures, and it doesn't give you very easy to work with streams ability to manage that. So I'm hoping that at some point we're going to see some improvements. So this is a scenario I don't have a good answer for because, you know, you kind of have to live within the framework of what Reactive Forms gives you, at least now. But the hope is that the team or a third party or the NGRX team will come up with some ways to help us make reactive forms actually be reactive.
Yeah, it's really misnamed. There's nothing reactive about reactive forms in Angular. And as a matter of fact, it's a matter of opinion. I think I can't find a way to use that thing. It's just so full of holes and it's so hard to use that I have no need for it. There are tiny features in it that I wish were in the template driven. And so sometimes I have to borrow a little reactive forms piece that really belonged everywhere and belonged in template driven. But for the most part, I don't have any use for it at all. I do just fine with the other.
You just go with, now you're using ng model in that scenario?
Yeah, I use ng model and I write the templates and I write half the code and have half a fraction of the bugs of the people who try and somehow shoehorn their lives into reactive forms.
Well, the funny thing is it's been around since the old AngularJS days, really. I mean, not exactly the same as it is today, but it's pretty close and it's worked all those years. So, yeah.
Yeah, the part of reactive
the template-driven stuff, not the reactive forms.
The reactive form stuff was
an invention that was supposed to be sort of halfway towards data-driven form generation, which itself, as Deborah knows, has had a long and sorry history of promise without delivery.
Correct. The one part of reactive forms that is reactive is that it does let you easily react to different other kinds of changes and then change itself. Like you can easily add control groups of like if you have an address and you want to allow another address block, where you can just repeat blocks of UI for data entry. It also reacts to things that the user might be doing and allows changing validation. But to me, that's just not enough, especially now that so many of the Angular developers are moving to a more declarative reactive approach using streams. It just doesn't meld well with what you have to do with forms. And since the forms structure itself too isn't serializable, you know, that makes it even more challenging to, you know, kind of fit it into like an NGRX approach also. So
you
could use some loving.
Yeah. By the way, when the solution that that they're working on in NGRX, it makes you think, oh my God, if I go for that, I'm in for the whole NGRX data and all of those actions and reducers and all that stuff. So I think it's worth pointing out that NGRX is a brand, and it means how do we bring Angular and RxJS together? And so they've got a number of little projects going on in there. And some of them, like the one that we're talking about for the components, have absolutely nothing to do with actions, reducers, or any of that stuff. I mean, obviously, it plays nice with that.
Sure.
But what they're working on there, you could just use that and say, I don't want that. You know, I want to use Dan's observable store, but I like what they're doing in terms of making components reactive. And you'll be able to
use even NGRX let. I mean, that would be really useful even if you don't do anything else NGRX.
Exactly. And so NGRX is kind of a brand or a whole or a sort of a circle of often very small libraries that focus on a particular problem relating to making an Angular app reactive. So it's worth taking a look at how that whole project is evolving.
Let's take a break to hear from our sponsor.
Hey Ward, you know, I was building an application the other day and I pulled in this really cool UI component, but it brought along a lot of dependencies with it. How do you deal with that?
I don't like that, John. It reminds me that the AG grid, which is an advanced editable data table that we use in a lot of our enterprise apps because it addresses the complex scenarios we encounter. AG grid doesn't have any dependencies at all.
Zero dependencies. Well, tell me, why is that good? Like, what is the value of having zero dependencies?
Well, it's wonderful not having to wonder if while I'm pulling that in, I'm also pulling jQuery in or Lodash or who knows what, in part because that's extra stuff coming over the wire. It's extra files that I don't know what they're all about. It means when my client's security team has to evaluate this, they're evaluating AG Grid and not everything else that might be slipping in under the covers or something that we have to worry about there.
You know, it's great to see this day and age, you can have a zero dependency library that does something like complex data grid functionality. So all of you out there, do check out AG Grid at their website at ag-grid.com.
We are currently in the process of updating our NGRX course for Pluralsight. But it is still focused just on the NGRX state or NGRX store.
Yeah, store. That's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah.
Not the NGRX data. NGRX data is like the cat's pajamas, but NGRX store is what we were talking about.
Right. So we're currently updating our NGRX course for Pluralsight so that it covers the new syntax that was new with NGRX 8. And so that should hopefully be out the end of June. Ish. Everything is harder now to do for whatever reason.
No, that's good though. That's good. Yeah, that's one thing. You keep your stuff very up to date. That's awesome. Ward, real quick while we're on it, because I know you've been on a big project for, gosh, is it years now?
But yeah, unfortunately, the years roll by. Yes.
Have you any, you know, Deborah's already shared three particular scenarios. Do you have any you've run into that
I have one, and I think that cool Deborah solutions. Will recognize this. And again, it has a lot to do with the forums. You know, when you get something that in off a stream, maybe it's the company record that you want to work on. You end up having to snapshot that. I have to snapshot that because. Although that can change, you know, as a result of other things happening in the application, I don't want it changing while somebody is making a change to the company record. I don't want it suddenly refreshing on me underneath it. So one of the patterns that I use a lot is I do something, I just call it a snapshot, where I'm just essentially taking the first element out of the stream and using that as a view model. And that freezes it. And now I can bind to that and make all my updates to the company record and stuff like that. And then when it's time to save it again, I reconnect with the stream from get the latest from whatever my store mechanism says is the current version of that. And I meld together the view model, which is my changes that I made on the forum with that. And then I save that out. But this whole idea of having to snapshot the value as it comes by. I find I'm using that technique a lot. Does snapshotting a moment in time in a stream come up in your world, Deborah?
Well, in the edit case that you're talking about, I usually end up making a copy. So just like spreading it so that I've got a copy to work with, if that's kind of what you're referring
exactly
to as
what
your
I'm saying.
Snapshot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you have something where you've got a list on the left and your edit page on the right, as they're editing, you don't want the list on the left changing until they've selected to save, assuming that's how you want your UI to work, where you have a actual user-driven save point. But some people and some users prefer to have it more immediate, where you don't actually have a save, that things are changed more live. So I think it kind of depends on what your user experience is and what your users are expecting, whether there is an official, I'm going to do a bunch of editing and then I'm going to decide whether I'm going to save or cancel, or whether you want something more live that as you're changing it, it's changing and there is no formal save process. It's kind of like, like Google Docs. Frequently, when you type stuff into a Google Doc, it saves by default. You don't have to continually say, I want to save it. So I think it kind of depends on your user experience that you're approaching for your app.
Right. Yeah, I'm often doing, in my big app, I'm often doing it when they leave the page. That's when I schedule a save. So
yeah,
I don't do it as they type. I'm sitting there typing Dan's name and I get the D in and then the A and the N. I'm not going to save it then. I'm going to wait until we've got the whole thing and they're ready to move on. So that's kind of But there are some cases, as you say, Deborah, where the user wants to see it in the list on the left-hand side as you're typing it, and that, then you want to be sharing the same instance across those two components.
You know, one thing on that I always find challenging, I guess, is when you go to settings type screens, because you know how some settings screens have a save button and others are just sort of live update like you're talking about. And maybe it's just me, but on those ones that don't have a save, occasionally I'll be there, okay, what do I do next? Oh, never mind, it's done.
Yeah.
You know, because you're just kind of used to having a save. You know, VS Code, for example, you know, you can edit the settings and it's just kind of live. You don't have to save, of course. And it's one of those UI things, like you said, Deborah, that you sort of have to cater to whatever your users are, I guess, most accustomed to.
We just ran into that this morning. One of the things that we've started doing recently just to start feeling normal again is going back to our local Starbucks, just through the drive-thru, even wearing your mask in the drive-thru, the whole nine yards. But you go up to the app to place your order, and when you place the order, you click a button saying, yeah, yep, I'm submitting this order. So you always have to remember to do that kind of okay. But if you then go back to the screen to add a tip, that happens right away. So my husband's like, I don't think that worked. And I'm like, yeah, I think it worked. Look, you get a little message here at the bottom that said that the tip was applied. But I didn't hit like say it, we're okay. And it's like, yeah, but I think it did it. I think it worked.
It's the inconsistency that gets
you. What if you meant to enter, I don't know, 5, but it was 50? Is it done?
Well then you know what, Dan? You've done a wonderful thing.
It only gives you 3 buttons, 1, 2, or 5. So we kind of were questioning that same thing. I mean, what would happen if you put 2 and then you wanted to put 5? Do you get 2 plus 5 or did you get 5 instead of the 2? But we were unsure about whether we wanted to mess with it. So we didn't touch it. We didn't want the credit card to get denied or something. But it is an interesting question. So it's awkward, especially if it's inconsistent throughout an app, that sometimes it requires you to say, yes, submit my order, but then adding the tip doesn't require any kind of verification or done or okay or something.
So I got one more for you, Deborah, that people stumble on which is, what's your feeling about converting observables to promises and getting to use a wait? Because that's actually pretty nice. So
do you have a
thought about that?
I personally think that adds confusion into your app to be, you know, mixing approaches. I would prefer to see everything just done in a stream. I also just read an article just recently, and if I can find it, I'll add that to the stream as well, about how async await can actually make you overly confident about what your code is doing. And it kind of has bitten people because they're thinking that they're okay when, you know, there's more going on than they might be thinking about. I'll just stick an async await on it. Personally, I prefer to stick to streams and not do to promise on stuff. I mean, if you look at things that Ben recommends, he always recommends that the only place you use a promise is to work with APIs that require promises. Otherwise, everything else should be streams. What do you think, Ward?
Well, actually, that last point, I think, is a really good one, because I've done some things where I converted promises. So I was if I'm going observables, I got to stay observables all the time. And so I backed off that, particularly when the API I'm dealing with is a promise-based API. And I seem to get into more trouble with converting it to an observable than just staying in the promise world when it starts in the promise world.
Yeah.
So I think Ben's statement there is pretty much aligning with my personal experience. And I'm pretty much with you. The one place I've actually found it useful to go take an observable and go to promise is when, and use a wait, is when I'm writing unit tests of observables. But that's a subject for another day. But that turned out to be it turns out to be a great way to test components and services that have observables in them, because it makes the test read better. Anyway, that's something for another time. Thank you, Deborah. I'm glad. I want to encourage everybody to go look at your courses on RxJS and see what you've come up with for your rewrite of the NGRX course as well. I hope we have these links in here.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing your knowledge with us, Deborah. It's always great to talk with you. These are definitely, I'm going to argue, some of the more challenging scenarios that I think Angular developers in particular, or really anyone using RxJS in their app, encounter. It's one of those things that once I call it the light bulb moment. Once it clicks, you're like, oh, this is awesome. But until it clicks, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is so freaking hard. You know?
What?
Exactly. Yeah.
Pretty much. But once you have that light bulb moment, it's just like, I get it. Okay, this is really cool. But so thanks for sharing those different scenarios and coming on with us today. So to wrap up, we always have folks share something that's interesting or a person or whatever it may be. So Deborah, I know you already had something in mind. So what would you like to kind of share with everyone today?
Well, I learned NGRX back when NGRX first came out. And when all of the new features came out, I was too busy to really spend any time with them. But just recently, I really dove into all of the new features. And if you looked at RxJS and thought it was too code intensive and gave it up, now might be a really good time to revisit that. Because, like, for example, it used to take 3 steps to create an action. You had to create a enum, and then you had to create a function, and then you had to union your types. And it was just all this mess and massive yuck. And now it's a one-liner. So I think it would be really, I thought it was really interesting to see what they've done and how much nicer that they made it. That started with NGRX version 8. It's currently NGRX version 9, but they haven't changed the syntax since 8. So that was my most interesting thing that I've run across over these last few weeks.
Excellent. Yeah, Brandon and Mike and Wes and the others involved, they've been doing a really good job on, I think, making it more approachable. You know,
exactly.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Mr. Ward, what do you have for us today?
Well, as usual, I'm not offering a technology one. I wanted to, I read an article in The New Yorker about bread. And because this is a time, you know, I'm baking bread. Isn't everybody? It was such a beautiful, heart-rending story of one of my favorite authors, Bill Buford, who writes about culinary things. His book Heat is fantastic. And it's his story of living in a French village and apprenticing to a bread maker in the town of Lyon. And this is how you use food to dig into a culture. Just a simple thing like bread, and dig into a whole culture, and a whole world emerges in the course of this article, and then it taps into grief and all kinds of human emotions. And how did you get there by just looking at bread? You get there because somebody wrote a great article. So I'm putting that article in here.
Awesome. That I'll have to admit, that's a unique one, Ward. But it's funny how many. The number of bread pictures on social media must have gone up by like 1,000%. You know, it's crazy. So cool. So I'm going to mention something that was announced this week, the week that we're recording the podcast. And it's really, really cool if you're really any type of developer, but especially a front-end developer. It's called Azure Static Web Apps. And I'll put a link here to a post I wrote up about it, but there's a lot of other great info out there. John, who's normally on the podcast with us, but couldn't make it today. But he gave a talk at it, and great info in like 15 minutes. So what it does in a nutshell is you can go to GitHub, put up your Angular, your React, your Vue, your Svelte, your Hugo, your Gatsby, your you name it, a static type, you know, front end. Define APIs. Now, if the app has APIs, they have to be Azure functions, but that's very easy to write in JavaScript if you haven't done it before. And then they will set up for you. You have to go to Azure and set this up, but if you go to my post, it'll walk you through step by step. They will actually set up all the build actions you need in GitHub. They'll deploy it to Azure. It'll be redundant, so it's resilient. Your APIs can have all kinds of traffic because that's how Azure functions are designed. But it's basically a way that now, I have just a demo app up there right now I'm running because it just came out in preview. But with just a deployment to whatever your branches you want to hit, for now I'm just using master, it automatically builds it, deploys it, and boom, you're all done. It's like as easy as could be. So definitely something to check out if you're interested in a more simplified way of deploying modern JavaScript apps, because we all know those aren't as easy as maybe you think at first glance. So cool. Thank you again, Deborah, for coming on with us. Ward,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate hearing your knowledge. And Ward, always good to hear from the magnificent, wondrous, whatever I said that
don't
you were
you
like.
Ever do that.
You're like, don't ever do that again. So with that, thanks everyone for tuning in. Check us out every Tuesday morning for the next episode of Real Talk JavaScript.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter at RealTalkJS.